From Lakeshore Public Radio, this is Regionally Speaking. I'm Chris Nolte. We're come to just days left in the 2011 General Assembly session. Let's find out what's been happening so far and what is ahead. We have with us Andy Downs. He's the Executive Director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue University Fort Wayne. As always, Andy, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, I know that there are some major bills that are still yet to be decided on. One in particular, one which has come up recently, I guess for lack of another name, is to call it the Emergency Powers Bill. Will you tell us what that's about, where it stands right now, and how close it might be to actually becoming law?
Yeah, this is House Bill 1123. There were a number of bills introduced this year that were going to attempt to limit the powers of the governor. And keep in mind, Indiana's governor is not one of the strongest governors in terms of institutional powers in the country. It's sort of middling. It has a number of powers that some other states don't. But in the grand scheme of things, not particularly powerful. But one of the ways that it does have significant power is that our legislature only meets for those first few months of the year. And the governor is the person, according to the Constitution, who has the power to call a special session. And when the legislators are not in session, they find it very difficult to do things that might be viewed as helping to keep the governor in check if the governor is doing things that they might consider to be things that can't wait until they get back into session for to deal with it in the normal way. So House Bill 1123, which passed the House and has now passed the Senate, is on its way for possible approval, but here's the trick. When it started out in the House, it was a little more stringent, took a little more power away from the governor. The Senate sort of took a couple of steps back. They amended the bill a little bit so that the powers were not quite as sweeping for the legislature or taking as many powers away from the governor. Now we have to wait and see if the House, if they wish, they can do what's called concurrence and simply say we agree with the bill that was passed by the Senate, in which case it's on its way to the governor. If the House disagrees, then it could go off to a conference committee where they might be able to work out differences of opinion between the two of them. But in the end, keep in mind, this is going to have to be signed by the governor, and the governor may choose to veto it, the governor may choose to sign it, or the governor may not sign it but let it become law. Mm-hmm. Each of those obviously sends a message to folks.
I know there's been one message that's already been spoken, and it's even from a former Indiana Supreme Court justice who is working, I guess, on a Senate Rules Committee about this matter. And the question is that the measure may be unconstitutional to begin with. It may not be allowed by the state constitution.
Yet the Constitution is pretty specific. It talks about when the legislative session occurs, and then it basically gives the governor the power to call an emergency session, or a special session, excuse me. That's it. There's
right.
Nothing else in the Constitution. And the part of the constitutional argument will probably be the fact that the Constitution specifically states a type of reason for them to meet, the special session, does not allow for other versions of this. The legislation that's moving through right now, 1123, actually refers to an emergency session, and they're going to argue, well, we're not calling a special session, therefore we're not violating the Constitution.
One of the other measures I know that has come up here, of course, in the session that has yet really to be done, it has gone through the process, is the next two-year state budget. That's a major item that they always have to handle every 2 years, and this is the year in the session to do it. Where do we stand on the state budget right now and its chances of passage soon?
You know, we often talk about three different versions of the budget, but it's probably more accurate to say five. Basically, the governor has a version of the budget that gets proposed. The House, which starts the budget process, says, no, this is the version we think it should be. And then the Senate says, no, this is the version we think it should be. Then eventually people from the House and the Senate get together in a conference committee to work out the differences between these three, keeping in mind that the minority caucuses in both the House and the Senate also throw in their two cents. So you really have five different versions of the budget that people are talking about. This is not unusual for them to be this late in the session and not have an answer to the question. And that's because they want to make the decision as late as possible, in part so they know what the revenue projections are saying. If the revenue projections come in a little rosier or a little more bleak, then they know that they, in their final negotiations, can add or subtract. We started the session, though, with a number of elected officials saying, our economic prospects might be better here than they are in other states, but we are at a time of great inconsistency or lack of certainty. So let's not add a lot of long-term expenditures to the budget right now, because the revenue that may come in may not come in which case we're going to be in a world of hurt. So you had a lot of legislators saying, let's do a lot of one-time expenditures. Let's not do things like raise teacher salaries, because that's long-term, that's ongoing. But let's go ahead and do things like, increase vouchers or create the education scholarship program, because those are things that could disappear in a year if necessary.
Are lawmakers still concerned about whatever they might be getting, and we know now a bit more about how much we're going to be getting from Washington, because Congress has passed the stimulus bill and the money is divvied out to state governments is on its way. Maybe know a little better how kind of impact it might have on the budget?
Yeah, this gets really interesting, because the state of Indiana did get literally billions of dollars more than it had anticipated getting. However, the law is a little ambiguous, but it pretty much says you have to spend this on COVID-related stuff. So, mm-hmm. In other words, you can't raise teacher pay because of this. You can't do some of the things that we might want to do long-term, but you could offset some other costs as long as you can figure out a way to say that they are COVID-related. So right now, that's another part of the discussion. It's not just what did the governor want, what did the House want, what did the Senate want. Now it's what did each of them want, and how can they supplement their budget desires with that billions of dollars coming from the feds. There's some talk even of ending up with a higher reserve than anticipated, which would trigger an automatic rebate to people, except the law says fairly clearly that the legislatures are not supposed to use this money for a tax break. The argument, of course, could be that they're not giving a tax break. They're simply creating a reserve, and that reserve is being used for the tax break. So, there may be some playing with words here, but they are in a very different position today than they were in, 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Yeah, we
and
know.
And that is both good and bad.
Yeah, we know lawmakers like to play with semantics. They like to play with words, and this is one of their opportunities to do so. Now, as we stand here at the end of March, going into April, and we know earlier that the session wants to end early, or at least the leaders want to end the session early. How do things stand as far as actually passing the budget's concern? Are they going to have to rush it through so that at the very last day of whenever it happens to be, the last day of the session, is when they'll pass it, which is, we know, pretty common for lawmakers?
Yeah, it won't be surprising if the budget passes the last day or a couple of days before the end. That is not at all uncommon. It would not be surprising to any of us who follow the legislature on a careful basis. And we do know that as of halftime of the legislative session, they were working at about the pace they normally work at in terms of passing legislation. So there's every reason to think that if they're setting that April 23rd or whatever date it was they've decided instead of the 29th, there's every reason to believe that they'll get that budget passed in the few days leading up to that, if not on that last day itself.
Now, are there any other interesting bills that are making it through the legislature that are liable to come up, at least for final passage and sent on to the governor for signature? We know a lot of bills always make it to some point, then they suddenly die or they suddenly get tabled. And are we liable to come into more of those than we will some ones that actually get up?
Yeah, it is an interesting session in that they put a limit on the number of bills, a smaller limit than usual on the number of bills they could introduce. So theoretically, they will pass fewer laws this year, but the success rate of bills introduced getting passed will probably come pretty close to matching previous years. But this is the point, like you said, where we see a bunch of things that look like they have stalled out or even died. So people who are interested in an issue that appears to have died really need to be looking for other bills that could become a vehicle, bills that are active that could be a vehicle for an amendment. One of the things I'll bring up will actually be weapons, handguns.
Mm-hmm.
There were originally something like 15, 16, 17 bills introduced that dealt with handguns in one way or another. At this point, there are pretty much only two that are still moving. But what may happen is people who have a part of a bill that died may want to try and introduce it into some other bill. One of those bills that's still moving through or is still technically alive is 1369, which is the one that deals with gun permits and lifetime permits. So that's one that probably has some decent chance of moving because of the number of people who are interested in the issue. Now, having said that, we do have to recognize that the events of the last couple of weeks may change people's attitude about this bill and make it more or less likely to pass, depending on what legislators believe and what the legislators are hearing from their constituents.
I know one other measure that has come up in discussion. It's called Senate Bill 260. It involves county election officials being able to scan absentee ballots up to 7 days before an election day happens. And I know the question that came up, that I know it certainly got my colleague Dan Cardin's attention. He wrote a story in the Times about it, was what State Representative Matt Pierce of Bloomington had to say. He's concerned about dead voters still making it on the polls. And of course, we know all about that here in Chicagoland. That's been always the practice or the theory in other states, that is, not Indiana. But the idea is that there are people that have passed on, still their names are on the polls and they can get counted as votes. Is that one of the issues that has still yet to be resolved that you know of?
Yeah, that the issue, and I want to be kind of clear about this.
Yeah.
Election day is still election day. The folks who administer elections want to be able to try and process as much of that as possible so that on election day we can get as close as possible to a bill that is done. I mean, an election that's done.
Right.
You know, we don't have to wait 3, 4, 10 weeks or whatever the case may be. That bill is actually still moving right now. In fact, it's waiting for the Senate to decide whether it will concur or not. If they concur, then it's done deal, goes off to the governor. If they don't concur, then it'll go to a conference committee for consideration by folks from both caucuses or both chambers and in both caucuses and both chambers.
Yeah.
But election day is election day, and if you are alive and you pass your and you file an absentee ballot 2 days before the election, but you die before the election, theoretically, you weren't alive on election day, and you should not be allowed to vote. So this is, you know, it's a small number of people this happens to, but I can tell you in the time I've been following elections, I know of instances when this happened, and absentee ballots actually had to be pulled out. The problem is if you scan the ballot and there's no identifier on the ballot, you don't know which one to pull out.
Yeah.
So there's a legitimate issue here, and there's a desire to balance out processing with security and timely results. It's not as easy as we make it sound sometimes.
Well, it sounds like that the last days of the session will, as always, be interesting. And as you mentioned earlier in our conversation, that we're not liable to get a 2-year state budget passed until maybe the day before, or maybe if we're lucky sooner before the session actually ends. But it is supposed to end early, we understand, if things go well.
It is, and you know, it's a beautiful day here in Fort Wayne. I hope it's a beautiful day where you are, and
yes,
you can understand why they might want to get out early and enjoy some of the weather. So
I don't
begrudge them that.
No, we can't blame them for wanting to finish up the session early, especially if there's some prospect of a decent spring ahead, to be sure. Well, Andy, as always, thank you for spending time with us to talk about what's going on at the General Assembly these days.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Andy Downs. He's the Executive Director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue University Fort Wayne. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. In partnership with the Legacy Foundation, Neighborhood Voice brings you conversations about COVID-19, the vaccine, and its impact on Northwest Indiana. Here's Erica Pfizer.
Neighborhood Voice explores community issues through the lens of local residents. We've spent time talking with entrepreneurs about their experiences running small businesses and how they've adapted during the pandemic. Now we're getting local perspectives on COVID-19, the vaccine, and barriers to accessing it. I'm your host, Erica Pfizer, and this week I'm joined by Jody Bella from Meals on Wheels of Northwest Indiana. Thank you, Jody.
My pleasure.
Yeah, and so do you think that those are protocols that you will keep in place? Have they helped your organization run more efficiently, or you think you're kind of going to go back to some kind of new normal once?
Yeah, you know, we don't even talk about going back anymore. Mm-hmm. We just know things have changed. And so we just look at it now as, so how will we change in the future to accommodate things? We utilize a no-touch delivery system right now, which does allow us to keep both the client and our delivery personnel safe. There's a possibility that could go back to where we could actually maybe see a client more face-to-face than mm-hmm. from a, you know, 8-foot to 10-foot distance. But like we instituted phone PAL program where we have volunteers that will call individuals in their home and just simply chat. And that has been huge. that's a huge social connection. And so that obviously will continue. Some of the things that we're doing in the kitchen, keeping the frozen meal, keeping how we're preparing food and, you know, those process flows and workflows, I think a lot of that we're going to keep. So, yeah, I guess the innovation and the push to do some different things have actually changed. And yeah, we just look at a new way of moving forward versus trying to think even remotely of going back.
Yeah. Well, and it has forced a lot of innovation, and it sounds like some new partnerships as well. You mentioned Continuum of Care. So have there been other partnerships that have formed out of this?
Absolutely. I think one of the things we most enjoyed was the such partnership, the reaching out, the working together with other nonprofits. We really just all experienced this. Okay, so how can we work together best to make it through and do what's best for everybody involved? The Salvation Army, we worked a lot with the Salvation Army. When this first happened, the casinos reached out to us, and all of us who work within the food arena in the nonprofit world, we all kind of like, okay, well, I can't use, you know, this donation from, you know, this casino, but I think so-and-so can. And so, you know, let me give you their number. And if you don't hear from them, let me know. And so we partnered a lot in that way. And it's like, okay, so you're really good at this. So how can you do this? And, you know, the food bank gave us space to store some of our shelf-stable meals so that if something did happen, we were completely prepared for our clients to never have to go without a meal. And so just it was just what I always think of as the region is generous, working together, making sure that we're taking care of everybody, very partnering, very neighborly thing. It really proved true for us. And so I hope other nonprofits feel the same as us, that it was, you know, a good time to partner and that they were successful and they had a good, you know, a good response partnering and that it was a good experience for them. We definitely enjoyed it.
One of the better things to come out of the pandemic, I think, is how people have worked together, found new ways to stay in contact with each other and to combat social isolation, even when we had to be distanced. And you had mentioned, you know, even with your delivery drivers, you know, not only are they dropping off a meal, but they're also doing wellness checks and that they are sometimes the only point of contact or person that someone may see when they're in their home.
Right. So our homebound clients, that's always been true. And now, you know, just some of our other clients, we're experiencing that as well. And, you know, I will say that our volunteers, we had some volunteers who are older that chose to, you know, kind of step back from volunteering for health reasons. You know, they wanted to stay safe and wanted to, you know, keep at home themselves. And we had other people who stepped up to fill that void for a number of reasons. And one of them was they were just, you know, now they might be working at home. So they had time to do something in the middle of the day, and they needed that time to get out of the house, to do something, to feel like they were connected to their community, that they were helping the community get through this pandemic. And so that was really refreshing to see. Mm-hmm. You know, you always hear kindness matters, and we were really fortunate to see some of that step up. Our client service department, the individuals who work in our client service are just amazing. I will say once they're there, they are on the phone nonstop. Everything from clients calling in because you know they're just lonely, to thanking us because they didn't know what they were going to do. They're so thankful for being able to have us there. And, you know, our client services will always call back and check. If somebody says they weren't feeling good, they'll call them back in a couple of days and go, how are you feeling now? And, you know, is there anything we can do? And so they really stepped up their game in helping individuals not feel isolated, as I'm sure all of us felt at some point.
Thank you for joining me, Jody.
Thank you, Erica.
And thank you for joining us this week on Neighborhood Voice. You can visit OurShot219.com for information about local COVID-19 resources in Northwest Indiana. This show is made possible by Legacy Foundation, the community foundation for Lake County, Indiana.
That was Erica Pfizer with the Legacy Foundation with conversations on Neighborhood Voice. And you can hear this podcast and others on lakeshorepublicradio.org. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversations to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
When you have a community that is not as diverse, then everyone loses because you don't have that experience with people who don't look like you, and you believe that everything should be a certain way, and that's ultimately what happened in Gary. When there was massive white flight, which was in the mid to late 60s, early 70s, there were many homes that were abandoned. And really more than that, because they didn't really abandon them, they sold them. But they sold them at a lower rate. And what happened was that there were a lot of folks who were able to purchase homes who could not maintain them. And so that sort of led to the compromise of the housing stock in the city of Gary. I had a neighbor down the street from where I live. She moved to Schererville. She walked away from her house, got a new mortgage in Schererville, and just walked away from her house, locked the door. And the impact, and the thing that really kind of drives me crazy, is that then, because it was a foreclosure, they have this fire sale and say that there's a house on sale for $15,000, which has a direct impact on me and my neighbor's property values. So let's say I want to move to a different area in Gary. Or let's say one of my neighbors wants to retire and move to Florida, one of our other neighbors. The sale of that distressed property, the sale of that foreclosed property, would serve as a comp or a comparable for any other appraisal that was done of my house, of the neighbor's house, of anybody's house in that area. And so as a result, it would push down our property values, even though our mortgages were paid up, even though we were doing everything we were supposed to do. And so things like that really frustrate those of us who are taking care of our property, who are working hard every day, and who have really made a life for ourselves and our families in Gary. The reason that I came back to Gary was that there were so many teachers, both in school and Sunday school, so many members of the community who took the time to inspire me. And so my theory is that if all of us who receive that inspiration move to other communities and decide, well, Gary is to this or Gary is to that, then who's going to inspire the next generation? And in some instances, I understand why people move. They move because they can. But my position has always been, and I've been very deliberate in where I lived in the city, that it was very important for all of us to live together so that children, our neighbors and other neighbors, could see people who were professional, who were doing important things on their block. And they could have a sense, I can be like them. That's what I had. I lived next door to teachers. I knew that I could be a teacher. I lived across the street from a guy who worked in the post office. I knew that I could work in the post office. I lived across the street from a nurse, from a general contractor. I knew I could do all of those things. Even though my parents, you know, they worked and they didn't necessarily have their own business. They weren't lawyers or doctors. Neither of them had completed college. But because of the neighbors that I lived around, I understood what I could do, and I had a clear sense that the sky was the limit.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. It's been a year of living through the COVID-19 pandemic in Indiana. When the stay-at-home orders went into effect in 2020, we brought you the story of an essential worker outside of healthcare who was risking his life to do his job. Juan Ruffin, a butcher at a Kroger supermarket in Indianapolis. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel checked back in with him 1 year later, a few months after he and his family had contracted COVID-19.
My 17-year-old probably had it the worst. He went through the whole loss of smell and taste and body aches and all of that stuff. I lucked out and only had a slight headache for a few days and was extremely weak for 3 or 4 days. My wife lost her sense of smell and taste and had a headache. I went to work and I told my supervisor, I said, I'm not gonna make it today. I just don't have anything. I was extremely weak. And he said, well, stay as long as you can and then, you know, go ahead and go home, because he knew it was something wrong. And it was worse the next day. I couldn't even get up. I missed a couple of days of work. And if you miss 3 days of work at Kroger, you have to go to the doctor. The third day, I was fine. And so I called my union rep, and she said, well, see if you can, you know, get tested. So I told her, I said, I can't make an appointment until Friday and I'm due back to work. I got tested on a Friday. I worked that Friday. I worked Saturday. Sunday morning when I went in at 5:00. They alerted me at 6:00 that I had tested positive for COVID. So when my manager walked in at 7:00, I said, what am I supposed to do? And he was like, well, you got to leave. I was quarantined from Sunday through Saturday. And my supervisor called me and said, you're supposed to come back to work on Sunday. And I was like, well, that's only a week that I've technically been quarantined, because I worked the 3 days before. You're supposed to be technically infected 2 days before you had symptoms. So that was technically 14 days, but I had not been off of work for 9. So I said, well, am I supposed to go get tested to make sure that I don't have it anymore to come back? And he was like, no, just come back to work. The one issue that we still have is this brain fog that doesn't go away. I still bake. And I go into the kitchen and I'll be like, okay, what did I come here for?
I tested positive for COVID the week of Christmas. And today is March the 9th, I believe. I clocked out for the end of my shift and walked out to my truck with the intentions on doing this video diary. But with a memory pause, I got in my vehicle, started it up, and headed home. And on my way home on the highway, I remembered, oh, I was supposed to do this video diary. Brain fog / memory pause is one of the things that we've all dealt with. Me and my wife have that conversation every day. I have to remind her of what she's needed to say to me, and she has to remind me of what I have to tell her. So that's my day. That's my life now.
It's hard with the social distancing to have the camaraderie. When you work with somebody a lot, you get to know them and you get to know their life situations. You don't get to interact like that as much. You know, it's always in passing now.
That's Juan Ruffin, who is a butcher at a Kroger supermarket in Indianapolis. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.